Late in the first century BC, some 40 or 50 years before the birth of Jesus, the Roman Emperor Augustus permitted people in one part of his empire to worship the reigning Emperor of Rome as the embodiment of the spirit of the empire. By the time we get to 50 or 60 years after the birth of Jesus, we have a situation where once a year, everyone in the empire was obliged to appear before the magistrates, to burn a pinch of incense before the statue of Caesar, and to say, "Caesar is Lord." Having done that, a man could go away and worship any god or goddess he liked, so long as that worship didn't infringe decency and good order in the empire. But he must go through the ceremony in which he acknowledged the emperor's divinity. And to fail to do this was to invite condemnation. Just what that condemnation involved would vary somewhat depending on whatever else the Roman governor of your particular part of the world had on his mind at that time. If he was busy off fighting battles, you might get away with it. If he was sitting in his mansion, wondering what to do with his time and how to show his power, he might well decide that exquisite torture of those who refused to worship the emperor would be a good way to go. And this situation presented a great dilemma for New Testament Christians. Did they stand back and refuse to honour the emperor in this way? Or did they go through the ritual, perhaps with their fingers crossed behind their backs, and get it out of the way for the year, and then get on with worshipping the Lord Jesus without fear of being thrown to the wild animals or tortured using red-hot pliers to sensitive parts of their anatomy or whatever else? Of course, sometimes the Christian's attitude to the emperor was irrelevant. Sometimes the local authorities would hassle and persecute Christians just because their enemies were making a lot of noise. This was the world, the people of the churches of the western end of modern-day Turkey, who were the original recipients of this book of Revelation. This is the world they lived in. And John wrote, under the direction of the Spirit of God, to strengthen and to encourage these Christians who were already suffering terrible things or who were about to suffer them just because of their faith in Jesus. As we come to think about the 18th chapter of this book, we have to keep in mind the purpose for which it was written. It was not written to provide gruesome stories with which to scare naughty children at bedtime. Yes, John did employ certain literary techniques and styles that would mean that if his writing fell into the hands of the Roman authorities, they wouldn't regard it as seditious. But its end purpose was to strengthen the local churches to remain faithful to Jesus in the face of adversity and pressure. And that is its purpose for us. Whatever conclusions we come to as we think about what John has written, it should be a means whereby we can be stronger in our walk with Jesus and in our faithfulness to him, both as individuals and as a church. This is a Christianly positive book. At the centre of the 17th and 18th chapters of it is this vile figure of the decadent prostitute lavishing herself in immorality and obscene indulgence. And it becomes quite clear that John is using this figure of speech and the image of the city of Babylon not to talk about a person, but a situation in life, perhaps in a city or even in the empire, or perhaps in a social situation. What he has to say here in chapter 18 can be thought about under three useful headings, and you've got them on the sheets that I think that you've got in your notices. The first is, Babylon, a city with one focus. Last Sunday, and as we thought about this book, part of this book last year, Richard and the others who talked with us talked about the various images and how they came to be and have the meaning that they have. We don't need to go into all that material again. Sufficient for us to say this morning that John's original readers would have recognized in this image of the prostitute city of Babylon a clear portrayal of the world in which they lived under the heel of the Roman boot. Tacitus, a Roman historian who lived toward the end of the New Testament period, described Rome as the place where all the horrible and shameful things in the world congregate and find a home. To that extent, Rome of its day was a match for the city of Babylon in its day. And together, these two cities point towards the sophisticated world of every society, where life is lived without reference to God, and where plans and purposes of God are either bitterly opposed or blindly ignored. This society is dominated by the worship of other gods. It is life as it is lived, worshipping the great God Me. Life in complete absorption with self. This is life lived to please me, shaped by what I want, giving to priority to whatever is the brightest blip on my radar screen. Truth in this city is what I choose to believe. Tolerance in this city means being prepared to allow me to do what I want to do, free of criticism and free of challenge. This image is life that is lived in fulfillment of the attitude of the people who built the city of Babel back in Genesis chapter 11, where it's recorded that they then said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heaven, so that we may make a name for ourselves." And this is the world in which you and I live. This is the community where not God, but human being is the pivot around which everything turns. What does the human being want is the question that decides every issue, every course of action, every standard of morality, every practice in business, every policy in government, every practice in private, family, and public life. In our society, this is the supreme rejection of God. People often think of godlessness in terms of idols and associated practices. But as we were reminded last week, mankind across the world rejects God and shatters that first commandment, "You shall have no other gods but me." Yes, there are those who shatter it by bowing down before images of stone or gold or wood or painted canvas or whatever. But in the Western world, that commandment is shattered by bowing down before the great God Self. A God that is worshipped by indulgence in all manner of sinful behaviour, and by the excessive indulgence in things which might of themselves be quite okay, but which we allow to assume a priority and an importance that they ought never have. Such behaviour is not just a different point of view. It is a blatant and outright rejection of God from the highest place that he ought to have by virtue of who he is and what he has done. He's the Creator. He's the Lord. He's the King of the universe. He's the one who in Jesus paid the price of our forgiveness, and to indulge self in first place is to tell him that he has no place, and that the I, the ego, is above all. Ancient Babylon was a civilization in revolt against God that had declared war on him and on those who stood for him as God alone. Rome was a civilization in revolt against God and that had declared war on him and those who stood for him as God alone. And as we look around our society, it's hard to escape the conclusion that we live in a civilization in revolt against God and that has declared war on him and on those who stand for him as God alone. But in our chapter today, John assures the people to whom he is writing that Babylon is a city under judgment. Listen to the repeated cry. Verse 2, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Verse 10, woe, woe, great city, O Babylon, city of power. In 1 hour your doom has come. Verses 16 and 17, woe, woe, great city. In 1 hour such great wealth has been brought to ruin. Verse 21, then a mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea and said, with such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again. John's message to those suffering Christians of Asia Minor was that the power and the arrogance of the persecuting Romans had a time limit. Just an hour, figuratively an expression for a short time. The political and economic and religious power of the Roman emperor and his agents was doomed to disappear. The Romans, of course, never believed and couldn't imagine that this moment, most permanent of empires, would ever fall. They certainly couldn't conceive of the idea that Rome herself would fall and be broken, that it could cease to be. Mind you, if we go back to Old Testament times, the powers of the Empire of Babylon would never have dreamed that their power base could be destroyed. But in Daniel chapter 5, we have the description of how in the middle of a feast given by King Belshazzar, the hand of God wrote on the wall, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parsin. And it was left to Daniel to interpret the words. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the scales and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes of the Persians. And that same chapter of Daniel ends by telling us that on that very night, the Medes and the Persians walked in and took over the Babylonian Empire in what was virtually a bloodless coup. And the power of Babylon fell under the judgment of God. It took some time, but in God's plan and his way, the power of Rome was broken. The anti-God forces took a battering when the Emperor Constantine became a Christian, but the godless nature of the empire came under final judgment, and its domain was broken up, and it ended up as nothing more potent than a whole lot of printer's ink on the pages of a history book. Could our world system as we know it cease to be? Current events are making us more and more aware that our world is vulnerable. For the people of the provinces of southwestern China, or those from the Irrawaddy Delta area in Burma, their world has come crashing to nothing. Jesus told his disciples, "When you hear of wars and rumours of wars, do not be alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places and famines. These are the beginning of birth pains." In saying that, Jesus was not laying out a timeline so that his people could track the rundown to the when the end of the world would come. Rather, he was putting before us a way to understand what is happening in the face of natural disasters and abuse of power and the great tragedies of life. They are there as stark reminders that our world and its structures are temporary. This world is passing away. The time will come, sooner or later, when the hand of God's judgment will reach out and godlessness in all its forms will be brought to a cataclysmic conclusion. When that does happen, the perpetrators of ungodliness and all those who have aided and abetted them will mourn and weep, but to no avail. And thus we have the pictures in the chapters before us in verses 9 and 10. When the kings of the earth, who committed adultery with her and shared her luxury, see the smoke of her burning, they will weep and mourn over her, terrified at her torment. They will stand far off and cry. Verse 11 and following, the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. They will say, "The fruit you longed for is gone from you. All your riches and splendor have vanished, never to be recovered." And the merchants who sold these things and gained their wealth from her will stand far off, terrified at her torment. And they will weep and mourn and cry out. And in verse 17, every sea captain and all who travel by ship, the sailors and all who earn their living from the sea will stand far off. They will throw dust on their heads and with weeping and mourning cry out. The picture of judgment is not a pleasant one. The language is complex, but the fact is stark and simple. This world and those in it who have declared that they have no place for God will find that he has no place for them. God says, "You want to reject me from being your Lord? Very well. I will withdraw, and everything good will go with me." And that is a situation too terrible for us to contemplate in detail. So what does John say to us should be our response? Babylon is a city to be abandoned. There is one message for those who have never surrendered to the Lordship of Jesus, that is the message of the whole Bible. God has acted in love, and by his death and resurrection, Jesus has taken the judgment of God's withdrawal on our behalf. The arrival of judgment time need hold no fear to those who have accepted Jesus and what he has done for them. Those who have this faith in Jesus are privileged to be able to be known as the people of God. But there is another message that John conveyed to those in Asia Minor whose faith was already in Jesus. A message to all Christians who find themselves living in a world where God is not honoured and where the God of me is worshipped. Look at it in verses 4 and 5. "Then I heard another voice from heaven say, 'Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues, for her sins are piled up to heaven and God has remembered her crimes.'" Come out of her. This is a call for clear and decisive Christian distinctiveness in the face of the inevitable judgment on sin. You know, back in that first century, there must have been enormous temptation for the Christians to whom John was writing to come to some sort of terms with the Roman world in which they live. After all, a pinch of incense was nothing, and if you didn't really believe that Caesar is Lord, then, well, what harm was done to say those words and thereby protect your own skin? But there are critical issues here. There's the honesty issue. If you don't believe in the lordship of Caesar, and you say you do, you're lying. The word of God is clear that the Christian's word is to be the word of truth. Our lives are to be lives of truth. Our lives are to show who is our Lord. And then the very act of saying those words is a denial of Jesus. Those who are standing by and hear or see the Christian profess another Lord will never hear or understand when that same Christian wants to speak to them about the lordship of Jesus. But you've already said your allegiance is somewhere else. I heard you. I saw you. And then compromise with the world of ungodliness leads to getting caught up in it. The classic Bible example is the Jews who were taken off to Babylon as exiles. Many among them grieved the whole time they were there, and they longed to be back to the faithful worship of God in Jerusalem. But there were others who accommodated themselves very nicely to Babylonian way of life. They set up businesses. They made handsome profits. They became very comfortable living off and living with the world of godlessness. So comfortable, in fact, that when the edict of Cyrus was proclaimed, allowing the Jews to return to Jerusalem, many of them refused to go. They had become so comfortable in the world that rejected their God that they were not prepared to leave it. Many of those to whom John was writing may not have perceived the urgency of their situation. The key to understanding this chapter is to recognize that action has to be taken, and it has to be taken now. There is no room for compromise with a world that refuses to honor the Lord, because we will end up failing to honor him as well. I was reading quite recently of a young woman who'd begun to dabble with the spirit world because all of her friends were doing so. She found herself on a spiral that led deeper and deeper into the occult thought patterns. And when finally she wanted to affirm Jesus as her Lord, her heart-rending cry was, "They won't let me." She was trapped. Christian compromise with godlessness can lead to Christian captivity in godlessness. And the weapons of godlessness are as effective as they are seductive. The soft sell of the advertising that tells us we just have to have things for no other reason than everybody else supposedly has them. The blatant contamination of our thought process by the sexual suggestiveness and policies of magazines and television that ends up telling us that homosexuality is okay, that sex outside of marriage is okay, because the rest of the godless world is doing it. the shaping of our thinking to believe that all sorts of behaviour patterns are normal. It's normal to get drunk. It's normal to tell filthy jokes. It's normal to flirt and play up to people who we aren't married to. It's normal to foul your body with drugs. It's normal to treat people from the opposite sex as if they're inferiors and need to be put down, even if it is supposedly only in fun. That climate that says that sharp business deal is good business practice, when it's really nothing more than deceit or lies. That putting one over your tax return is clever, when it's really nothing more than breaking the law. The acceptance of the thinking that says a bigger house, a more expensive car, a better garden, children who are more successful, being admired by those we work with or socialise with, these things are more important than doing what God says. These things and multitudes of others like them are the lies of a society that it's turned its back on God and wants to serve the great God me. This is the thinking of Babylon the whore. This thinking is that which stands under the condemnation of the sentence of God. This thinking is that which draws one word from the throne of God for those who wish to remain faithful to Jesus. Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, and so that you will not receive any of her plagues. It's time, my friends, for you and for me to hear the word of the Lord and shape our lives accordingly. It's not for me to add or to take away, but simply to lovingly and thoughtfully ask you, how will you, how will I respond? Not just in words, but in reality. Does our allegiance lie with Jesus or with Babylon the harlot? Can we take a moment to pray? Just in the quietness, take a moment to reflect whether there are particular areas in our lives as individuals where we have stumbled into compromise with the thinking of the godless world.